Her withdrawal marks President Biden's first failure as he seeks Senate confirmation for his cabinet nominees. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Daniel Strauss. The piece is titled, Neera Tanden Withdraws as Cabinet Nominee After Facing Opposition. Stay with us for more of Daniel Strauss's article. Joe Biden speaks to head the Office of Management and Budget. Neera Tanden has withdrawn her nomination after she faced opposition from key Democratic and Republican senators over her past controversial tweets. Her withdrawal marks President Joe Biden's first failure as he seeks Senate confirmation for his cabinet nominees. I have accepted Neera Tanden's request to withdraw her name from nomination for Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Joe Biden said in a statement. I have the utmost respect for her record of accomplishment, her experience and her counsel, and I look forward to having her serve in a role in my administration. She will bring valuable perspective and insight to our work. Neera Tanden's confirmation had faced increasingly steep odds. Republican senators who opposed her nomination cited tweets attacking members of both political parties prior to her nomination. And last week, Joe Manchin, a conservative Democratic senator, announced he would oppose her nomination, also citing her tweets. That left Tanden short of the majority of votes needed on the Senate floor and in the committees involved. Joe Manchin, a key moderate swing vote in the Senate, said last month, her overtly partisan statements will have a toxic and detrimental impact on the important working relationship between members of Congress and the next director of the Office of Management and Budget. Susan Collins, the Republican senator from Maine, meanwhile cited Joe Biden's own standard of conduct in opposing Neera Tanden, declaring in a statement, her past actions have demonstrated exactly the kind of animosity that President Biden has pledged to transcend. Neera Tanden was an unexpected choice to run Biden's budget team. She is a longtime ally of Hillary Clinton and has often vocally criticized both Republicans and Democrats, especially supporters of Bernie Sanders. Neera Tanden has said in her confirmation hearings that she regretted the past statements, but that wasn't enough to sway the required number of senators. 11 of Joe Biden's 23 cabinet nominees requiring Senate approval have been confirmed, most with strong bipartisan support. Unfortunately, it now seems clear that there is no path forward to gain confirmation, and I do not want continued consideration of my nomination to be a distraction from your other priorities, Neera Tanden wrote in a letter to Joe Biden. Tanden needed just 51 votes in an evenly divided Senate, with Kamala Harris, the vice president, acting as a tiebreaker. But without Joe Manchin's support, the White House was left scrambling to find a Republican to support her nomination. One potential Republican vote, Lisa Murkowski, a senator from Alaska, told reporters early on Tuesday that she still had not yet made up her mind on Neera Tanden's nomination. The White House had stuck with Neera Tanden even after a number of centrist Republicans made their opposition known, insisting her experience growing up on welfare and background working on progressive policies whilst running the liberal-leaning Center for American Progress made her the right candidate for the moment. Ron Klein, the White House chief of staff, initially insisted the administration was fighting our guts out for her. Tanden apologized during her confirmation hearing to people on either the left or right who are hurt by what I've said. Just prior to the hearing, she deleted hundreds of past tweets, many of which were critical of Republicans. The Republican senator, Susan Collins of Maine, cited those deleted tweets in her statement, saying that the move raises concerns about her commitment to transparency. She said Congress has to be able to trust the Office of Management and Budget Director to make countless decisions in an impartial manner, carrying out the letter of the law and congressional intent. The head of the Office of Management and Budget is tasked with putting together the administration's budget, as well as overseeing a wide range of logistical and regulatory issues across the federal government. Neera Tanden's withdrawal leaves the Biden administration without a clear replacement. The apparent frontrunner is Shalanda Young, a former staff director of the House Appropriations Committee, who has been actively pushed by members of Congressional Black Caucus. Other names being mentioned include Anne O'Leary, a former chief of staff for Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, and also Jean Sperling, who served as a top economic advisor to both Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama.
Iran Today.
2015 was the year of a landmark deal, the JCPOA, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But before it could take off, action had its wings clipped. In 2018, the former U.S. government pulled out of the deal. But this year has, with modest moves, also accomplished something as significant: steps taken to save the JCPOA from demolition. That is a good prospect, but it is not to say Iran is banking on it. The JCPOA, or nuclear deal, was between Iran and P5 plus one countries. Those are the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. 22nd February saw a logical turn of events. Iran was to put an end to free-at-will nuclear inspection on that day if the U.S. didn't lift all sanctions as commanded by the JCPOA. Sure enough, the U.S. didn't lift sanctions. But contrary to expectation, Iran struck a deal directly with the U.N. nuclear watchdog. This would buy 3 months more to give diplomacy another chance to perhaps make the deal work. In the meantime, Iran's nuclear activity would be recorded all the same, but by Iran itself. I'm Leila Faramanzi. After 3 months, should sanctions still not be lifted, Iran will destroy the recordings. That will leave a gap in the nuclear watchdog's reports on this country. The E3, that's the UK, France and Germany, are uncomfortable with that, although they haven't done much to give Iran incentive to the contrary. Sanctions refer to the UN's nuclear-related economic sanctions imposed on Iran. These were settled by the JCPOA, but when the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the deal in 2018, it reimposed and reinforced the sanctions as U.S. sanctions. Our interviewees today are all political experts. First to go, Mr. Zarei tends to believe U.S. sanctions are imposed to stay, which leaves no room for complaint about the Iranian response.
To revive the JCPOA, Iran says it's not enough for the U.S. to just re-enter the deal. They have to lift sanctions. Now, let's say the U.S. doesn't immediately do so. How far do you think they're going to go in pressuring Iran with sanctions?
I believe that the policy of sanctions against the Islamic Republic is a well-established American policy. Biden cannot take steps to eliminate it, even if he wants to, because this policy is planned behind the scenes by centers of power such as the AIPAC, and they are the ones who decide on Iran-US relations. This continues to remain so. It's been the case since the Carter era, when the first game of the sanctions was played, until today, 42 years later, across all US administrations, no matter Democrats or Republicans.
So far, the West has taken some symbolic steps to salvaging the nuclear deal. The E3 are brokering talks. The US is willing, Iran not yet so. Because sincerity on the part of the US and Western parties to the deal, Iran suspects. The West would be wise to hold JCPOA talks, that is, nuclear-related talks. But they appear to be using talks as a confidence-building strategy to push for more terms, and Iran will not scrap its ballistic missile defenses for anything. That is one of the new terms the West has been pushing for. Mr. Fazaeli sees the issue of holding talks as no more than a redundancy.
If it can be called a development, do tell of the latest development, which is Iran all of a sudden saying it's not, definitely not going to sit down to talks.
To say that we won't go back to the negotiating table may be misinterpreted. Our position is that we have already come to negotiate and spent a lot of our country's time, but did not see any results. We are now ready to negotiate under the same framework of P5 plus 1. Provided that we see the fruits of our previous lengthy negotiations. Because negotiations are not done for the sake of talks. They are carried out for a specific predefined purpose that both sides have already agreed upon.
Mr. Khoshchesh contributed to the discussion by Skype.
To them, talks only mean a means to for containment of Iran's power. That's why they have not been loyal to their undertakings. The major merit they have always promised to provide to Iran has been the removal of sanctions. That's been their major undertaking in all these agreements. But they have never done that because they look at the sanctions as part of, as a weapon and as part of their strategy of containment, which relies very much on military threats as well as sanctions in order to push Tehran to the talks and then receive merits and try to slow down Iran's growth in various military and nuclear industries.
Iranians, both civilian and official, hailed their government's move. Even staunch principalist individuals and papers called the deal between AEOI and IAEA a logical move in maintaining national interests. AEOI is the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran and IAEA is the UN nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency. Now, not everyone in Iran is happy with the government's logical move. The majority of parliament, mostly principalists, headed by House Speaker Ghalibaf, are up in arms. Why are MPs so incensed? Well, the US both pulled out of the nuclear deal and continued to find new ways to sabotage what was left of the deal. So finally, parliament or Majlis decided to roll its dice in a different way. It passed an urgency law in December 2020, which was to be executed from 22nd February 2021, unless the U.S. returns to the nuclear deal and, more importantly, lifts sanctions off this country. After all, the nuclear deal was intended to keep an eye on Iran's nuclear program and limit it in return for sanctions relief, not sanctions increase. The new law was called the Strategic Act of the Islamic Consultative Assembly to remove sanctions, and it gave the US time to lift sanctions. Apparently, the US needs a lot more time, and for giving it that time, Parliament wanted to refer the administration's deviation from the parliamentary bill to the judiciary. But after the recommendation of Iran's leader for resolving differences, the two bodies are settling their dispute through a joint committee.
Speaking of the Parliament's law, if we want to scrutinize it meticulously, with an emphasis on legal matters, one can find some flaws in it. We can say that some of the words used in the agreement need to be more accurately interpreted. But on a macro level, I believe what transpired, meaning the measures the government took and what the IAEA did, wasn't compatible with the Parliament's resolution. Of course, the Parliament's reaction is understandable. The lawmakers were worried, based on what happened before, that there could have been an oversight by the government and that the law might not be implemented. This was a reaction which one could argue was sort of an overreaction.
Iran has come to a point when it refuses to sit and wait for its rights to be thrown at it breadcrumb at a time. So it decided to further exert pressure on Western signatories to the deal to get sanctions lifted once and for all. That is why on the 2nd of December last year, Parliament proposed the said law. The final act of that act would be to halt free at-will inspections of nuclear sites by pulling out of the additional protocol to the NPT, which allows surprise inspections of nuclear sites. NPT stands for Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
It was an agreement that somewhat prevented tensions in relations between Iran and the IAEA without breaching the law passed by the Iranian parliament. It gave the IAEA a three-month deadline to make attempts so the West upholds its commitments under the JCPOA and Iran would not have to abandon implementing the additional protocol altogether. In my opinion, it was a good joint opportunity to continue the relations between Iran and the IAEA and to reduce the level of tension between the two to some extent.
President Biden did promise a return to the deal in his electoral campaign. He doesn't have much political capital to fall back on, but there are ways around that. Some solutions proposed and reported in The Guardian are that the U.S. could quietly end its obstruction of Iran's $5 billion IMF request for COVID relief, or give the nod to the release of frozen funds in other countries under arrangements ensuring they are used for humanitarian purposes.
They need to realize that the sanctions did not deliver the results they desired, because they are exerting pressure to force us to change our ways. They need to realize the attempts haven't been effective and have failed to bring about any change. And we are even getting stronger. For example, on the nuclear issue, the issue of enrichment to a 20% purity level has been raised. The leader of the Islamic Revolution also hinted at the possibility that we raise that level to 60% purity. When they see that their attitudes will lead the Islamic Republic to act in such ways, I think if they are smart, they will change their approach.
The problem with U.S. sanctions is they are said to be aimed at regime change or behavioral change on the part of governments sanctioned or boycotted. But actually, you can't really impose sanctions on a government without immense collateral damage inflicted on its people. So U.S. sanctions don't work. They don't achieve said goals and often even backfire, which gives cause to reason. U.S. sanctions are not to serve U.S. foreign policy, but only to serve the interests of politicians.
I'm not saying they'll lift the sanctions. They won't. We don't see any signs of goodwill. Our position is that they weren't even after clinching the JCPOA. They were looking beyond it. They thought they could use the JCPOA as a platform because the nuclear issue is neither a remarkable advantage to Iran nor a serious emergency for the West. If we have access to the third, fourth, fifth, or sixth generation centrifuges, they are way ahead of us. They ask us not to make nuclear bombs, which we don't want to make, but they have such weapons themselves.
So far, some couple of dozen countries suffer some form of U.S. sanctions, which are said to have left hundreds of thousands, even millions, suffering in the world. And the Trump-era sanctions imposed on Iran have been the harshest ever in U.S. history. To Iran, however, the notion of sanctions was nothing new. They've been ongoing for four decades since the Islamic Revolution and the war imposed on this country by Saddam Hussein and a world of allies in the 1980s. So Iran is still standing. Before carrying on, let's take a look at some other media outlets to see what they have to say on our topic of the day. Now that we're hands-on, what do they actually have to say, beginning with the European Council on Foreign Relations? Fool me once. How Tehran views the Iran nuclear deal. Europe and the U.S. should focus their efforts on swiftly returning to the original nuclear agreement with Iran rather than holding out for the unlikely prospect of better terms. While there is still a possibility that the agreement will be revived, it increasingly appears to Tehran that the process will be a marathon and not a sprint. There is one point between Iranian leaders on which they all agree. Tehran must end its strategic patience in the implementation of the nuclear deal. The rhetoric for public consumption varies between different camps in Iran, who differ on the extent and method of the response. However, political elites now generally agree that Iran should not allow itself to be duped by the United States again, and that Tehran should not reverse any steps to accelerate its nuclear program until Washington is certain to ease sanctions in return. The Atlantic Council says with Iran, nuclear diplomacy comes first. If Iran wanted to renegotiate the JCPOA framework or add other topics to the agreement, it would have done so while the Donald Trump administration was in office and punishing Iran with maximum pressure sanctions. The reality is that Iran is not ripe for a grand bargain. The JCPOA was achieved because negotiators realized that the only way to reach a resolution was to isolate the nuclear issue. For example, in 2017, Anthony Blinken, now Biden's Secretary of State and Deputy Secretary under the Obama administration, said, "In an ideal world, we would have negotiated every misbehavior that Iran conducts, both at home and around the world. But we live in the real world, not an ideal world. The only issue that our partners were prepared to negotiate, including the Europeans, including China, Russia, not to mention Iran, was the nuclear program." Tasnim News has it. Russia urges U.S. to show commitment to JCPOA by lifting sanctions on Iran. Russia sees a chance to resurrect the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and is proposing a synchronized approach, including concrete steps by the Biden administration to help Iran and the U.S. break their deadlock, the country's top negotiator said. "There's a chance now that hasn't existed for a long time," Ryabkov said in an interview Wednesday in Moscow. "We have to try and use it." Ryabkov said the U.S. should show its commitment to rejoin the nuclear deal by starting to lift the freeze on Iranian assets and oil exports, while Iran should gradually restore its compliance with the agreement. And that's the news section for today. Back to our narration. The U.S.'s miscalculation is no surprise, but it is quite easy to miscalculate the complexity of the Iranian economy. Iran is a relatively big country with many borders and a population of some 85 million. Yes, unemployment and high inflation and a devalued rial remain bitter realities. But it is manufacturing that accounts for a fifth of Iran's employment.
Everyone in Iran, from officials of, from different parties and different political camps to the population, to people, the average citizens, everyone now believes that the U.S. is not serious, is not honest, and is not going to remove the sanctions. Therefore, everyone believes now in resistance. That includes, of course, expanding ties with other nations, including the Chinese, as well as the Russians and the regional nations, and also working the domestic economy. Altogether, the Iranians now believe that they need to reinvigorate their domestic or national economy, as it's called, the economy of resistance.
This country has substitute industries to fall back on with enough manpower in waiting and quite a few neighbors and friends to find ways to export its goods to. With banking sanctions, it is difficult to come by the raw materials needed for manufacture, but factories haven't come to a halt, and cars and metals and plastics are still being produced. As Susan Maloney, an Iran specialist at the Brookings Institution, put it, Iran does have a reach that goes beyond that of the U.S. Treasury Department.
Joe Biden himself seems to be in a sort of impasse domestically with the sanctions. What other policy might he adopt in order to make the deal work?
Deciding on what we want to do is more important than what the Americans want to do. As long as we wait for the Americans to do something, this problem won't be solved. We need to make our own decisions and suppose that the sanctions are going to stay in place. We need to make plans about how to run the country under these circumstances, which is quite possible. That is, if there is a better coherence and trust in the existing capacities of the country, and we use the capacities properly, with the experience we have gained in resisting sanctions, we can certainly be much better off from now on and improve the situation even if sanctions aren't lifted.
Joe Biden was vice president to the level-headed President Obama, in whose time the JCPOA was inked to lift sanctions in return for controlling Iran's nuclear program. But even then, the final lot was not tied. And now President Biden, in spite of his election promise to return to the JCPOA, began by demanding Iran return to full compliance before he gets back into the deal. Well, Iran's in no rush. This country is happy to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes to 60% enrichment, up from its 20%. It was the U.S. that pulled out to begin with, and Iran expects the U.S. to take the first step. A step-for-step mutual return to the deal Iran is content on. Or is it?
The fact that Mr. Zarif came up with a solution doesn't mean that the Islamic Republic has decided on it. We did not accept the step-by-step approach at all. Iran has said that all sanctions must be lifted in accordance with the JCPOA. We're saying that in order for us to retrace the steps we have taken over the past year, you need to lift the sanctions, but not in a gradual or step-by-step manner. We're at the 100th step, we've honored our obligations step-by-step, and are now standing at the last one.
Iran does insist. The onus is on the offending party to return, restart, and compensate for the damages, as well as to reassure that they would not renege again.
This kind of strategy that's called fortifying sanctions wall would serve the U.S. containment strategy, no matter it's a Biden or an Obama or a Trump administration. That's exactly what the Donald Trump's national security advisor said, that no matter who would win the election, the presidential election, this fortifying sanctions wall would serve the United States' negotiating power and the containment strategy towards Iran.
The recent U.S. attack on the Syria-Iraq border has raised Iranian suspicion further. The U.S. military on February the 25th struck a site in Syria used by two anti-Daesh paramilitary groups said to be backed by Iran. This was in response to rocket attacks against American forces in the region in the past 2 weeks, which the Syrian groups said they had nothing to do with. Biden's act was frowned upon not only in this region but at home, as he didn't seek the necessary congressional authorization for a military strike. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Saeed Khatibzadeh said that the U.S. troop presence in Syria was illegal, and he accused the country of training terrorists. Ro Khanna, a California Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, told CNN, "There is absolutely no justification for a president to authorize a military strike that is not in self-defense against an imminent threat without congressional authorization. We need to extricate from the Middle East, not escalate." Biden is now the fifth consecutive U.S. president to order strikes in the Middle East or West Asia.
There's no reason for the Americans to want to target an Iraqi unit that is serving at a critical point of the conflict with Daesh in the Deir ez-Zor region of Syria. This attack has raised a big question. Well, the answer to that question is that the Americans have revealed a secret alliance with Daesh. Why should Kataib Hezbollah and the PMU, who are part of Iraq's security forces, come under attack by both the US and Daesh at the same time? This raises a serious question.
Apparently, the U.S. attack was on a site used by Iraqi Hezbollah militias near Al-Hurri village, right on the Syrian-Iraqi borders inside Syria. Kataib Hezbollah did claim that one of its fighters had been killed and that he was stationed on the Iraqi-Syrian border to protect Iraqis from Daesh or ISIS criminal gangs. The Iraqi government did complain about the U.S. undermining its sovereignty when also in late December 2019, the U.S. struck Kataib Hezbollah in Iraq.
Another point is that the Americans said that this was in retaliation for the operation that took place against a military base in Erbil, which was an incident that happened 5 or 6 days ago. About 16 rockets were fired at the American base, killing and wounding a number of them, and now the Americans responded by attacking an almost empty base, resulting in only one martyr and 4 wounded. While the Americans took unjustifiable action against the forces that had officially denied involvement in the Erbil affair, they were very cautious about taking a limited measure. This indicates the fear of a backlash from the Iraqis against the US troops in the Arab country.
Whatever happens, neighbors matter. Here's what Qatar's Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani said in a meeting with UK, French and German ambassadors to Doha. He said that his country supports diplomacy and dialogue on the issue of Iran's nuclear deal, JCPOA, while stressing the importance of all parties' fulfillment of their commitments to the deal. Al Thani emphasized that Qatar is ready to support any action that promotes stability and security in the region and international peace.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Don't forget to return to the box at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate on Press TV. I'm your host, Behrouz Chafi. Finally, the International Criminal Court has opened a formal investigation into crimes committed by Israel against Palestinians in the occupied territories. The ICC chief prosecutor has asserted the court will adopt a principled and nonpartisan approach. Palestinians have favored the move, which they regard as a long-awaited step. Israel and its key supporter, the U.S., have strongly opposed this. The White House has stressed it will go on to uphold full commitment to Tel Aviv. Now, will the ICC be able to put an end to the impunity and bring the Israeli criminals to justice? We'll discuss those questions and similar issues after going to Ramallah to our correspondent, Mona Kandil there. Mona, tell us how the Palestinians feel about this.
Well, the Palestinians praised the move, and the Palestinian Authority urged world states to refrain from politicizing these independent proceedings, especially that the ICC announcement has angered both the United States and Israel, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying clearly that Israel is under attack today, and that the biased ICC in The Hague made a decision that is the essence of anti-Semitism and hypocrisy. So Palestinians today are very happy for this decision by the ICC, but at the same time, they are questioning that would the United States be allowing, of course, it has furiously condemned the court, would it be allowing the prosecution of Israeli officials and forces, especially that it immediately condemned the ICC? More of the Palestinians, of course, have demanded the International Criminal Court to look into crimes during the Israeli war in the Gaza Strip in 2014, as well as the ongoing Israeli settlement activity and expansion in the occupied West Bank and in Jerusalem. Al-Quds, the Palestinians also expressed their readiness to cooperate with the ICC with preparing numerous files that would be giving, let's say, would be helping the ICC to prosecute Israeli officials and military officials in the Israeli regime.
Okay, definitely. They have the footage of those protests and even targeting media people along with women and kids. Thank you for that. That was Mona Kandil telling us about how the Palestinians feel about this. Now, joining me in this debate show will be MEP with the Ireland South, Mick Wallace, is in Brussels. And we'll also have former UN rapporteur in the occupied territories, Richard Falk, who is joining us out of Yalıkavak, I believe. It must be in Turkey. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, let's go to Mick Wallace, Chief Prosecutor. Fasuda is speaking of having conducted a painstaking preliminary examination that lasted almost 5 years, and she's promised an independent, impartial, an objective investigation without fear or favor. Would that be possible?
It will be very difficult without fear or favor. I mean, she's already highlighted the fact that they're under-resourced. And listen, they find it difficult to operate, right? You, if you look at the history of the ICC, you will see that they struggle to get good results a lot of the time. And, you know, you have the very fact that the likes of the Americans and the Israelis don't even recognize it. I mean, is a problem because obviously the U.S. and Israel think they're above international law. But it's a good move that this has happened. It's good that the ICC have gone to this space and addressed the issue. But I wouldn't be jumping up and down about the prospects of getting a great result. Now listen, it's not rocket science that the Israeli military forces in the West Bank and Gaza commit terrible war crimes on a daily basis. But for the ICC to come up with that, they're obliged to initially allow both sides, the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, to actually do their own investigations. And because that's just as part of the format. So what we're going to have now first is the Israeli government will actually be allowed to investigate allegations of criminal activity on the part of their military. Mm-hmm. And that'll be a whitewash for sure, 100%. Right? That's guaranteed to be a whitewash. Now, how the ICC deal with that then remains to be seen. And it'll be very challenging for them. I'm not saying that we're not going to get a decent result out of it, but I'm just saying it's hard to be optimistic that we're going to get the full truth. There'll be serious opposition to this.
Okay.
Israel, US, don't want the truth told about what the Israel does to the Palestinians on a daily basis.
I'll come to those questions later on in the show. Now let me turn to Richard. Benjamin Netanyahu has called the probe an anti-Semitic attack. You know, whatever you talk about Israel, they call it anti-Semitic. Is this really anti-Semitic attack?
That's really an absurd and outrageous response to a judicial process that has leaned over backwards to be careful and judicial in the best sense. And it I think, expresses more than anything else the hopelessness of the Israeli position if one considers the substance of these allegations about minority in the occupied Palestinian territory. It is such a clear-cut set of facts backed by evidence, and the only recourse that Israel has is to denounce the institution and to act as if it's not accountable for any kind of violation of international law. And that's really very bad for, it's a bad precedent, it's irresponsible, but it's understandable because Israel has all along defied international law, and it's had the geopolitical backing of the United States. Having said that, it's still a momentous decision if nothing else happens, because it legitimizes on the level of symbolic politics, which are very important in these struggles, the claims and the grievances that the Palestinian people have felt, and the very outrage that Netanyahu expresses is actually a confirmation of the weight of these grievances. And so the ICC has already done itself incredible positive credit by launching this investigation, even if no behavioral results in terms of indictments and convictions and punishments result from it.
Right. Now, Mick, ICC insists that it has reason to believe that Israeli authorities have committed war crimes. You know, it took them 5 years to do this preliminary probe, and on that basis they are making this a statement. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think Richard's point is a very strong one. Whatever comes out of this now, it's been something really positive that they've gone to this space at all. And I'm sure it wasn't easy for them. And I think it puts pressure on the EU in particular. Unfortunately, right, Israel does what it likes and totally disrespects international law on a regular basis because it can. And the reason it can, obviously, is because the US will allow them to do anything they want. And unfortunately as well, people need to take on board that the EU bears responsibility too. And I would argue that the complicity of the EU and the silence of the EU in the face of terrible atrocities being committed against the people of Palestine, the Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gaza, the people displaced outside the country in refugee camps and wherever, the treatment of those Palestinians is abysmal, and the EU bears responsibility for not standing up for the human rights of the Palestinians. They talk about human rights in areas where it's geopolitically suitable, but they ignore them a lot of the time where it doesn't suit the US. Because they have behaved for too long like a puppet of the US. Mm-hmm. And I would say that this decision by the ICC to go to this space is going to put extra pressure on the EU to actually face up to the truth and become more involved in addressing the plight of the Palestinian people.
Okay. Now, Richard, speaking of the U.S., you know that Washington has expressed disappointment with and also opposition to this ICC move. And what does it mean? I mean, a crime is a crime, no matter who commits it, right?
It should be. But the geopolitical reality is that it's a crime if it's a weak state. It's if it's a strong state, there's no accountability unless it happens to lose a big war, as Germany and Japan did after World War II, and then there's some procedures of accountability for the losers. But the real message is there are double standards with respect to international criminal law. The weak can be held accountable, the strong and their friends are given impunity. And that's a sad and glaring weakness in the kind of world order that exists in the world today. And it's been so blatantly exposed in the way in which Israel has treated the Palestinian people now for decades. And the world watches, and I agree with what Mick said about the EU having complicity. There is no responsible reason for not backing the ICC in exercising its authority as it's vested in an international treaty. Mm-hmm. And if you read the documents that it has issued and the long preliminary investigation that it conducted, it's beyond reasonable doubt that there were crimes committed, that it is appropriate to hold Israel and Hamas. We haven't mentioned the fact that the ICC also has is investigating crimes that are alleged to have been committed by Hamas in the form of using indiscriminate rockets in the 2014 skirmish with Israel. So that the undertaking is really the most dramatic and significant in the history of the International Criminal Court, and will bring, I think, great credit to it if it's able to persist, at least to the extent that it won't give way to the kind of pressures that Israel, the United States, and maybe some other countries will exert.
Okay. Now, Mick, both of you referred today you as an accomplice to the U.S. in blind support for Israeli crimes. You're a member of European Parliament. Tell our viewers what you or maybe your colleagues have done or planning to do regarding exposing the Israeli crimes within the European Parliament.
Well, for those of you that follow, I'm on the Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm also on Security and Defense. And a lot of the plenary sessions that are held once a month for a week cover foreign affairs matters. In fact, a huge chunk of the plenary is devoted to foreign affairs. I would ask the people themselves to judge as to whether we're having an impact, but we're not afraid to speak out. We are not beholden to anybody. We fight for justice anywhere in the world, and we see it as our responsibility at all times, and without fear or favour. We're not pandering to an electorate, wondering, are we going to get elected the next time if we don't do this or we don't do that, or if we say this or we say that. We were in the Irish Parliament for 8.5 years, myself and Claire Daly, and we didn't pander to the electorate, but we still kept getting elected, and we got elected to the European Parliament. And obviously, in the European Parliament, no one would be surprised to hear that at least 90% of the European Parliament, of the 705 MEPs, I would say 90% of them are of an Atlanticist nature, which is unfortunate. But I would also argue that while 90% of the members of the European Parliament we find ourselves in opposition to on a daily basis, I would argue that they don't fairly represent the citizens of Europe. There's 450 million people in Europe, and I would say the majority of them are completely in favour of the Palestinians being treated in a fair manner and then being put to what is a form of genocide against the Palestinian people by Israel for a long time now. That is not what the European people want. It might be what a lot of the politicians in the European Parliament sign up to, because they are in the pockets of lobbyists who have a vested interest in pushing them in a particular direction.
Okay. Now, Richard, how would Washington's all-out support for the Tel Aviv regime affect the tribunal's probe?
Well, of course, it's hard to tell. It has no legitimate basis for exerting influence whatsoever. The tribunal is supposed to operate as an independent international institution. The U.S. is not a party to the treaty constituting this international criminal court, and it really is obliged to act responsibly by allowing it to function in accordance with its own constitutional framework. And if it doesn't allow, there will be a civil society effect of this decision, which we shouldn't overlook. It will help things like the BDS campaign that has been trying to exert nonviolent pressure on the Israeli government to uphold international law and to acknowledge and address the grievances of the Palestinian people. And this decision, even if it doesn't result in any behavioral outcomes, will be a tremendous support, will lend tremendous support to the global solidarity movement that may in the end be the most significant outcome of what has happened so far.
Okay. And Mick, the ICC is also intending to probe Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, the illegal settlement activity, and also the deadly response to anti-occupation rallies that happened in 2018. How serious and what type of verdict would you issue for those crimes and illegal land grab?
Listen, that's kind of too easy a question in some ways. A big concern for me today is that international law is not being fully respected by the international community. And it's a sad time when we have the likes of the European Union introducing sanctions against countries like Iran, like Syria, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, you name it, introducing sanctions that are actually illegal. Sanctions are only illegal if they are backed up by a UN resolution. Most of the sanctions that are being applied today, and the Americans have sanctions against 38 countries, and very sadly, Europe supports a lot of them. But the demise of international law is really worrying. I'm not saying that it's going to continue, because I actually don't believe that the European Union can continue on this path of being a complete puppet to US imperialism. And I would like to think that we will get back to a point where the EU really does respect international law and holds the likes of the Israelis to account for the atrocities that they commit against anybody.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. That's all the time we have. Let me thank our guests. We had the MEP of Ireland South, Mick Wallace, in Brussels.